friends, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, with a literary and loving salute to the woman who helped you learn to read, who took you to the library each week to nurture your love of books, and who read bedtime stories to you at night. That's right. Hey, moms, this one's for you. An entertaining mix of fiction, nonfiction, and conversations with some diverse and fascinating guests. Our Mother's Day tribute begins as we turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Based on the true story of the life of Jeanette Wall's grandmother, Half Broke Horses is the endearing tale of Lily Casey Smith, a woman born into poverty in the early 1900s in West Texas. Intelligent despite a spotty eighth grade education, Smith knows her purpose on earth is more than just breaking in horses on her daddy's farm. She sets off across the desert at age 15 to teach children in Arizona. Smith is scrappy and independent, clearly a woman before her time. In her early 20s, when she learns the traveling salesman she married already had a wife and kids, she puts her pearl handle six-shooter in her purse, hunts him down, and gives him a good pistol whipping. Walls, best-selling author of The Glass Castle, brings her grandmother's story to life in a first-person voice that is authentic and irresistible. And she performs the book.
Buster, who was 9, was perched up in the big fork of the tree. I was 10, the oldest, and I took charge, telling Buster to trade places with Helen so she could sit upright without having to cling too hard. A little while later, it got dark, but a bright moon came out, and we could see just fine. From time to time, we all switched places so no one's arms would wear out. The bark was chafing my thighs, and Helen's too. And when we needed to pee, we had to just wet ourselves. About halfway through the night, Helen's voice started getting weak. "I can't hold on any longer," she said. "Yes, you can," I told her. "You can because you have to." "We were going to make it," I told them. I knew we would make it because I could see it in my mind. I could see us walking up the hill to the house tomorrow morning, and I could see Mom and Dad running out. It would happen, but it was up to us to make it happen. To keep Helen and Buster from drifting off to sleep and falling out of the cottonwood, I grilled them on their multiplication tables. When we'd run through those, I went on to the presidents and state capitals, then word definitions, word rhymes, and whatever else I could come up with, snapping at them if their voices faltered. And that was how I kept Helen and Buster awake through the night. By first light, you could see that the water still covered the ground. In most places, a flash flood drained away after a couple of hours. But the pasture was in bottomland near the river, and sometimes the water remained for days. But it had stopped moving and had begun seeping down through the sinkholes and mudflats. "We made it," I said. I figured it would be safe to wade through the water, so we scrambled out of the cottonwood tree. We were so stiff from holding on all night that our joints could scarcely move, and the mud kept sucking at our shoes. But we got to dry land as the sun was coming up, and climbed the hill to the house, just the way I'd seen it. Dad was on the porch, pacing back and forth in that uneven stride he had on account of his gimp leg. When he saw us, he let out a yelp of delight and started hobbling down the steps towards us. Mom came running out of the house. She sank to her knees, clasped her hands in front of her, and started praying up to the heavens, thanking the Lord for delivering her children from the flood. It was she who had saved us, she declared, by staying up all night praying. You get down on your knees and thank your guardian angel, she said, and you thank me too. Helen and Buster got down and started praying with Mom, but I just stood there looking at them. The way I saw it, I was the one who'd saved us all, not Mom and not some guardian angel. No one was up in that cottonwood tree except the three of us. Dad came alongside me and put his arm around my shoulders. There weren't no guardian angel, Dad, I said. I started explaining how I'd gotten us to the cottonwood tree in time, figuring out how to switch places when our arms got tired, and keeping Buster and Helen awake through the long night by quizzing them. Dad squeezed my shoulder. Well, darling, he said, maybe the angel was you. We had a homestead on Salt Draw, which flowed into the Pecos River in the rolling, gritty grassland of West Texas. The sky was high and pale, the land low and washed out, gray in every color of sand. Sometimes the wind blew for days on end, but sometimes it was so still you could hear the dog barking on the Dingler Ranch 2 miles upriver, and when a wagon came down the road, the dust it trailed hung in the air for a long time before drifting back to the ground. When you looked out across the land, most everything you could see, the horizon, the river, the fence lines, the gullies, the scrub cedar, was spread out and flat, and the people, cattle, horses, lizards, and water all moved slowly, conserving themselves.
We've just heard Half Broke Horses by Jeanette Walls. Jodi Picoult's best-selling novels about family and love tackle hot-button issues head-on. In The Storyteller, a book which many believe is her most intimate to date, Picoult chronicles the relationship of Sage Singer and Joseph Weber, a beloved Little League coach and retired teacher. As their story develops, Joseph asks Sage for a favor she could never have imagined, to kill him. When Joseph reveals the heinous act he committed, Sage wonders if he may truly deserve that fate. But would his death be murder or justice? An ensemble cast performs the work.
At our last meeting, our facilitator, Marge, had suggested that we share a memory of whatever it was we had lost. I see that Shayla is clutching a pair of knit pink booties so tightly her knuckles are white. Ethel is holding a television remote control. Stuart has, again, brought in the bronze death mask of his first wife's face. It has made an appearance a few times at our group, and it was the creepiest thing I'd ever seen. Until now, when Mrs. Dombrowski has brought along Herb. Before I have to stammer my answer, Marge calls our little group to order. We each pull a folding chair into the circle, close enough to pat someone on the shoulder or reach out a hand in support. In the center sits the box of tissues Marge brings to every session, just in case. Often Marge starts out with a global question. Where were you when 9/11 happened? It gets people talking about a communal tragedy, and that sometimes makes it easier to talk about a personal one. Even so, there are always people who don't speak. Sometimes months go by before I even know what a new participant's voice sounds like. Today, though, Marge asks right away about the mementos we've brought. Ethel raises her hand. This was Bernard's, she says, rubbing the television remote with her thumb. I didn't want it to be. God knows I tried to take it away from him 1,000 times. I don't even have the TV this works with anymore. But I can't seem to throw it out. Ethel's husband is still alive, but he has Alzheimer's and has no idea who she is anymore. There are all sorts of losses people suffer, from the small to the large, You can lose your keys, your glasses, your virginity. You can lose your head. You can lose your heart. You can lose your mind. You can relinquish your home to move into assisted living, or have a child move overseas, or see a spouse vanish into dementia. Loss is more than just death, and grief is the gray shapeshifter of emotion. My husband hogs the remote, Shayla says. He says it's because women control everything else. Actually, it's instinct, Stuart says. The part of the brain that's territorial is bigger in men than it is in women. I heard it on John Tesh. So that makes it an inviolable truth? Jocelyn rolls her eyes. Like me, she is in her 20s. Unlike me, she has no patience for anyone over the age of 40. Thanks for sharing your memento, Marge says, quickly interceding. Sage, what did you bring today? I feel my cheeks burn as all eyes turn to me. Even though I know everyone in the group, even though we have formed a circle of trust, it is still painful for me to open myself up to their scrutiny. The skin of my scar, a starfish puckered across my left eyelid and cheek, grows even tighter than usual. I shake my long bangs over my eye, and from beneath my tank top, pull out the chain I wear with my mother's wedding ring. Of course, I know why. 3 years after my mom's death, it still feels like a sword has been run through my ribs every time I think of her. It's the same reason I am the only person from my original grief group still here. While most people come here for therapy, I came for punishment. Jocelyn raises her hand. I have a real problem with that. I blush even deeper, assuming she's talking about me, but then I realize that she's staring at the urn in Mrs. Dombrowski's lap. It's disgusting, Jocelyn says. We weren't supposed to bring something dead. We were supposed to bring a memory. He's not a something, he's a someone, Mrs. Dombrowski says. I don't want to be cremated, Stuart muses. I have nightmares about dying in a fire. Newsflash, you're already dead when you're put into the fire, Jocelyn says, and Mrs. Dombrowski bursts into tears. I reach for the box of tissues and pass it toward her. While Marge reminds Jocelyn about the rules of this group, kindly but firmly, I head for the bathroom down the hall. I grew up thinking of loss as a positive outcome. My mother used to say it was the reason she met the love of her life. She'd left her purse at a restaurant, and a sous chef found it and tracked her down. When he called her, she wasn't home, and her roommate took the message. A woman answered when my mom called back and put my father on the phone. When they met so that he could give my mother back her purse, she realized he was everything she'd ever wanted. But she also knew, from her initial phone call, that he lived with a woman who just happened to be his sister. My dad died of a heart attack when I was 19, and the only way I can even make sense of losing my mother 3 years later is by telling myself now she's with him again. In the bathroom, I pull my hair back from my face. The scar is silver now, ruched, rippling my cheek and my brow like the neck of a silk purse. Except for the fact that my eyelid droops, skin pulled too tight, you might not realize at first glance that there's something wrong with me. At least that's what my friend Mary says. But people notice. They're just too polite to say something, unless they are under the age of 4 and still brutally honest, pointing and asking their moms what's wrong with that lady's face.
That was The Storyteller by Jodi Picou.
This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful.
Thank you.
Paul's All-You-Can-Eat Diner is a home away from home for an inseparable trio from Plainville, Indiana. Dubbed the Supremes by high school pals in the 1960s, these gals weather life storms together and have done so for more than four decades. In Edward Kelsey Moore's The Supremes at Earl's All-You-Can-Eat, the women faced their most challenging year. Talented Clarice must struggle to keep up appearances as she deals with her husband's humiliating infidelities. Fragile Barbara Jean is rocked by tragic reverberations of a youthful love affair. And fearless Odette engages in a terrifying battle while contending with the idea she's inherited more than her broad frame from her notorious pot-smoking mother. Through marriage, children, happiness, and the blues, these strong, funny women gather each Sunday at the same table at Earl's Diner for delicious food, juicy gossip, and occasional tears. Aidan Rally Ojo and Pamela DiPella narrate.
Other than the faint growl of James snoring three rooms away, the only sound in the kitchen was the bass whoosh made by the lopsided ceiling fan churning above my head. I turned on the kitchen light and looked up at that fan wobbling on its axis. With my toes smarting and still longing to distribute my bad humor, I decided that even if I couldn't justify snapping at James about my hot flash or my sore toe, I could surely rationalize letting off some steam by yelling at him for improperly installing that fan 18 years earlier. But like my desire to wake him and demand empathy, I successfully fought off this temptation. I opened the refrigerator door to get the water pitcher and decided to stick my head inside. I was in almost to my shoulders, enjoying the frosty temperature when I got the giggles, thinking how someone coming up on me, head stuffed into the refrigerator instead of the oven, would say, "Now there's a fat woman who is completely clueless about how a proper kitchen suicide works." I grabbed the water pitcher and saw a bowl of grapes sitting next to it, looking cool and delicious. I pulled the bowl out with the pitcher and set them on the kitchen table. Then I fetched a glass from the dish strainer and brought it to the table, kicking my house shoes off along the way in order to enjoy the feel of cold linoleum against the soles of my bare feet. I sat down at what had been my place at the table for three decades and poured a glass of water. Then I popped a handful of grapes into my mouth and started to feel better. I love that time of day, that time just before sunrise. Now that Jimmy, Eric, and Denise were all grown and out of the house, the early hours of the day were no longer linked to slow passing minutes, listening for coughs or cries or, later, teenage feet sneaking in or out of the house. I was free to appreciate the quiet and the way the yellowish-gray light of the rising sun entered the room, turning everything from black and white to color. The journey from Kansas to Oz, right in my own kitchen. That morning, when the daylight came, it brought along a visitor, Dora Jackson. I clapped my hand over my mouth to stifle a squeak of surprise when I first caught sight of my mother strolling into the room. She came from the direction of the back door, her short, wide body waddling with an uneven stride from having her left leg badly set by a country doctor when she was a girl. People used to call us the twins, Mama and me. The two of us are round women, big in the chest, thick around the waist, and wide across the hips. We share what has often been charitably called an interesting face. Narrow eyes, jolly cheeks, broad forehead, big but perfect teeth. I grew to be a few inches taller, 5'3". But if you were to look at pictures of us, you'd swear we were the same woman at different ages. My mother loved the way she looked. She would strut through town on her uneven legs with her big breasts pointing the way forward, and you knew from looking at her that she figured she was just about the hottest thing going. I never came to love my tube-shaped body the way Mama loved hers. But learning to imitate that confident stride of hers was probably the single smartest thing I ever did. Mama wore her best dress that Sunday morning, the one she usually brought out only for summer weddings and Easter. It was light blue, with delicate yellow flowers and green vines embroidered around the collar and the cuffs of the short sleeves. Her hair was pulled up, the way she wore it for special occasions. She sat down across from me at the table and smiled. Mama gestured with her hand toward the bowl of grapes on the table and said, "Are you out of ice cream, Odette?" "I'm trying to eat healthier, maybe take off a few pounds this summer," I lied, not wanting to admit that I was thinking of the grapes as a first course. Mama said, "Dieting's a waste of energy. Nothing wrong with having a few extra pounds on you, and you really shouldn't drink so much water at this time of day. You were a bedwetter." I smiled, and in a childish show of independence, drank more water.
That was a sample of the Supremes at Earl's All You Can Eat by Edward Kelsey Moore. Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue, and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. The story we usually tell about childhood and success is the one about intelligence. Success comes to those who score highest on tests, from preschool admissions to the SATs. But in how children succeed, grit, curiosity, and the hidden power of character, Paul Tough argues for a very different understanding of what makes a successful child. Drawing on groundbreaking research in neuroscience, economics, and psychology, Tough shows the qualities that matter most have less to do with IQ and more to do with character, grit, curiosity, conscientiousness, and optimism. How Children Succeed introduces us to a new generation of scientists and educators who are radically changing our understanding of how children develop character, how they learn to think, and how they overcome adversity. It argues for new kinds of thinking on ways to steer children toward a successful future. Dan John Miller narrates.
And they spend long hours engaged in mature dramatic play. Extended, complex, make-believe scenarios that the designers of Tools of the Mind believe naturally teach children how to follow rules and regulate impulses. As I watched the kids in room 140, I found myself thinking, inevitably, about Ellington, the tiny life form cooing and burping and wailing away 30 miles to the north in our studio apartment in Manhattan. I knew I wanted him to have a happy, successful life, but I didn't really know what exactly I meant by that, or just what my wife and I were supposed to be doing to help guide him there. I wasn't alone in my confusion. Ellington was born into a particularly anxious moment in the history of American parenting. And that anxiety had grown especially keen in cities like New York, where the competition over slots in favored preschools verged on the gladiatorial. A pair of economists from the University of California recently dubbed this nationwide contest for early academic achievement the Rugrat Race, and each year the race seems to be starting earlier and growing more intense. 2 years before Ellington's birth, the Kumon chain of tutoring centers opened New York City's first junior Kumon franchise, where children as young as two spent their mornings filling out worksheets and completing drills on letter and number recognition. Age three is the sweet spot, Kumon's chief financial officer told a reporter for the New York Times. But if they're out of a diaper and can sit still with a Kumon instructor for 15 minutes, we will take them. Ellington would be growing up in a culture saturated with an idea you might call the cognitive hypothesis, the belief, rarely expressed aloud but commonly held nonetheless, that success today depends primarily on cognitive skills, the kind of intelligence that gets measured on IQ tests, including the abilities to recognize letters and words, to calculate, to detect patterns, and that the best way to develop these skills is to practice them as much as possible, beginning as early as possible. The cognitive hypothesis has become so universally accepted that it is easy to forget that it is actually a relatively new invention. You can trace its contemporary rise, in fact, to 1994, when the Carnegie Corporation published Starting Points, Meeting the Needs of Our Youngest Children, a report that sounded an alarm about the cognitive development of our nation's children. The problem, according to the report, was that children were no longer receiving enough cognitive stimulation in the first 3 years of life, in part because of the increasing number of single-parent families and working mothers, and so they were arriving in kindergarten unready to learn. The report launched an entire industry of brain-building 0-3 products for worried parents. Billions of dollars worth of books and activity gyms and Baby Einstein videos and DVDs were sold. The Carnegie findings and the studies that followed in their wake had a powerful effect on public policy, too, as legislators and philanthropists concluded that disadvantaged children were falling behind early on because of insufficient cognitive training. Psychologists and sociologists produced evidence linking the academic underperformance of poor children to a lack of verbal and mathematical stimulation at home and at school. One of the most famous of these studies, which I wrote about in my first book, Whatever It Takes, was conducted by Betty Hart and Todd R. Risley, two child psychologists who, beginning in the 1980s, intensively studied a group of 42 children from professional, working class, and welfare families in Kansas City. Hart and Risley found that the crucial difference in the children's upbringings and the reason for the divergence in their later outcomes boiled down to one thing: the number of words that the children heard from their parents early in life. By age 3, Hart and Risley determined, the children raised by professional parents had heard 30 million words spoken to them. The children with parents on welfare had heard just 10 million. That shortfall, they concluded, was at the root of the poorer kids' later failures in school and in life.
That was How Children Succeed by Paul Tough. Dr. Siobhan Dolan is a Harvard Med School trained physician and is certified in obstetrics and gynecology. She is also a geneticist and a public health specialist. Dr. Dolan is the medical advisor to the March of Dimes. Her book, Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby, covers pregnancy and birth from your first prenatal visit to month-to-month changes as your baby grows and the changes that occur in your own body during pregnancy. Questions about nutrition, exercise, delivery, and beyond are dealt with in a wonderfully accessible and informative book. Welcome, Dr. Dolan. Thanks for joining us today on The Book Report, and I want to congratulate you on a book that is a wonderful resource, and it's packed with great information that is so easily accessible.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
All right. When a woman announces she's pregnant, she is absolutely flooded with advice from all corners. Are there some practices that our mothers followed that differ from today's medical guidelines?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, one thing that we see with trends over time that may have been different for our mothers or grandmothers is that women are having their children a little bit later in life. So that's one issue. And then another issue is there's a lot going on now with obesity and weight and so forth. So there's some background trends that may, you know, influence what's going on. Now, with regards to the individual woman, the message is pretty straightforward, and it's the title of our book, Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby. We want women to be in the tip-top, best medical shape they can be in, and then if they can address any medical conditions, get on a prenatal vitamin, and then go ahead and get pregnant, we hope to get them started in the best possible shape and then go ahead, see their OB provider, either a midwife or a doctor, and proceed during their pregnancy. Advice from moms and grandmoms, you know, I think it's very well-intentioned, but each woman, I think, needs to look at her own personal circumstances and kind of sort through what advice is helpful to them and what is not. And that's one of the other messages of our book. we talk about options. We give women options. There's not only one way to do a lot of things. So we want to give information that's absolute, like take a prenatal vitamin with folic acid, like no safe level of alcohol during pregnancy. So there's some absolutes. But then we give lots of different opportunities and examples for places where there are options, like what kind of food to eat, what kind of snacks to take, what kind of provider to see, what kind of pain relief to have in labor. There's not one solution for that. So each woman needs to look at her own circumstances and hopefully get some information and advice from our book and take mom and grandmom's advice, but then sort through it and see what's best for you.
Okay, so no glass of wine with a Saturday night dinner, huh?
No, absolutely not. I know that advice is still out there, and interestingly, it's come up quite a bit since I started talking about it, but, you know, alcohol affects the developing neurologic system, so there's really no safe level, and we don't know about the amount or the timing and so forth, so really, advice is pretty clear to stay away from alcohol altogether.
All right. Now, my grandma told me that nursing mothers should drink beer, that it's actually great for breast milk. Is there any truth in that?
Not that I know of medically. It's interesting. I would be curious to hear where, you know, what the data or what the thinking was behind that. But no, in fact, we would advise against drinking alcohol while nursing. Similarly to the message while pregnant, there's no good reason for a fetus or a newborn to be exposed to alcohol. So the more mom can stay away from that, the better.
All right. If you crave a food during pregnancy, we've all been told it's because your body really needs some element of that food. Is that any truth in that?
You know, that's another interesting question. Some cravings or aversions can be in the same breath. So in other words, some women feel they don't want to drink coffee, as an example, and people say that that's protective. You know, the idea of cravings could be desiring certain foods, like salty foods, as an example. And so those kind of cravings are not too concerning, and I think women should go ahead and feel comfortable to eat, you know, pickles or ice cream or different things. But some cravings can be concerning, and those can have some, you know, mental health component to them as well. In other words, you can be some anxiety or some depression, and that may spark up around cravings. So, you know, if it's a craving that is something that's not worrisome, I think women should go ahead. Treat yourself well while you're pregnant. Take good care of yourself. It's a tough time, a lot going on, and, you know, most cravings don't represent a major problem. But cravings for things that are not food or cravings for things like alcohol that we advise against, if those come up for women, we definitely recommend seeing their provider to try to discuss what's really going on. Is it a mental health issue? Is it stress? Is it a nutritional deficiency? Well, that could be uncovered, and then, you know, maybe you need additional iron or an additional nutritional supplement. So getting to the bottom of those cravings can be really helpful, and the provider can help you do that.
What are the over-the-counter medicines that pregnant moms should avoid?
You know, over-the-counter medicines in general for symptom relief don't represent a major problem, but it's important to really look at what you're taking. So as an example, acetaminophen, which is the drug name for what's in Tylenol, doesn't represent a problem. So if you have a headache early in pregnancy, go ahead, take a pain reliever and feel better. What can be a challenge is when women get to the point of taking the multi-symptom medications where there's many, many different components in the same medication. So as an example, the, you know, cold and flu multi-symptom kind of medications that you can get over the counter. I recommend against those just so that women actually identify what symptom they have, what they're taking, and know exactly what they're taking. Single agent medications over the counter in general are safe, and the message there is to talk to your doctor, talk about what symptom you're having, make them aware that you're pregnant, and then identify the best medication for that particular symptom and feel better by all means. So we don't want pregnant women suffering through every single symptom. There are plenty of safe alternatives out there.
All right. If you're expecting a normal delivery, do you really need to attend Lamaze classes? It seems that they're not as popular as they once were.
Education in general, in my opinion, is really empowering for women, and that's a big part of why we wrote this book. We want women to enter labor and delivery feeling like they know what's going on, feeling in control, feeling empowered, that this is their labor and delivery. This is not something that's happening to them. This is something that they're experiencing. So however one gets their knowledge, we're all for it. However you get your information, go for it. So for some women, that's a book, and that's why we wrote this book, Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby, and we hope women will enjoy it. For some women, it's a class, so a Lamaze class or a class at your local hospital or at your doctor's office, that's fabulous. For some women, it's going to be online now in the internet, and as part of our book efforts, we put together a series of videos that are available on YouTube free of charge. So if you go to YouTube and just Google, YouTube, just do in the search line, actually, prenatal care, there's a whole bunch of videos that we've made through March of Dimes, and we want, you know, we realize that pregnant women are young, they go to the internet, and we want to be there. We want to provide information in that fashion as well. So however you get your information, go get some information. Get yourself ready. Go into labor and delivery excited and full of the knowledge you need to have a healthy mom and a healthy baby at the end.
Well, I'm on the board of directors of our local March of Dimes here, and I know that the organization carries on research that benefits all babies, not just preemies. Talk about that.
Absolutely. March of Dimes has been instrumental in research around moms and babies for 75 years. This is a really exciting year for us because it's our 75th anniversary. And so while the organization started in the fight against polio, the organization was successful and has really turned its attention to moms and babies' health. You know, we work on so many issues and provide research funding for issues like vaccinations, genetics research, prevention of birth defects, and currently we're working hard on the prevention of preterm birth, which is such a common problem. And we're being successful, so we're delighted to continue to fund research and spread educational messages for moms and babies.
Now, is your book, Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby, available everywhere? How can someone get it?
Absolutely. Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby is available anywhere books are sold, which nowadays may mean Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, but you can also go to the bookstore. And actually, my co-author, Alice Kelly, and I were just discussing it, and she saw it in her local Barnes & Noble on the display table, and my neighbor saw it as well. So we're delighted that the book's out there and available anywhere books are sold.
Well, Dr. Lone, I have to tell you, it is so easy to use and so packed with wonderful information. I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Elaine.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Since her time on Saturday Night Live, Julia Sweeney has established herself as a witty, captivating performer of one-woman shows. Her TED Talk, sharing how she explained the birds and the bees to her 8-year-old daughter, ignited an incredible response. Now, when it comes to talking about motherhood, people want to hear what Julia has to say. If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother is her compilation of stories, revealing her painfully funny adventures and her poignant personal story of deciding to adopt as a single mom, her transition to a traditional family after she married, and how she took on the role of an at-home mother. Julia, who performs the work, imparts a cutting-edge take on parenting with a definite appreciation for the absurd.
Week 1. Unto me a child is given. Chapter 1. If it's not one thing, it's your mother. Because the pillow that I dream on is a threshold of a world I can't ignore. Silver Jews, my pillow is the threshold. First things first, let me bring you into the house which you may notice is quite old by American standards. It's located in Wilmette, Illinois. It has a history, this house. It used to be the village hall and was originally built in 1878. This house was in existence when the Battle of Little Bighorn was going on a mere 1,000 miles to the west. Why this fact is meaningful to me, I'm not exactly sure. But this house, the door frames, the old plaster on the walls of the front rooms, the staircase banister, it links me in time to history, however humbly. My house sits near the Wee Town Center, which has a train station. In just 28 minutes, you can be in downtown Chicago. Michael and I bought this house nearly 4 years ago, after we married. Mulan and I moved from Los Angeles, moving in with Michael, who was already living a mile from here. We pasted ourselves together and formed a family. When I saw this house for the first time, I had that Brigham Young-like sensation. This is the place. I was in love at first sight, but I pretended to consider other houses, like dating around before you get married to the person you know you'll marry. This house and I were meant for each other. We both knew it. Plus, like Brigham Young, I was really tired and wanted to stop. The house has been remodeled many times over the years, but the front part of the house is the oldest part. There's a guest room just to the right of the front door. In the guest room, we have an antique double bed, and we call it the Grandma Room. This is because it's often used by Michael's mother, Norma, or my mother, Jerry, when they visit. On the bed is a decorative pillow. My mother gave this pillow to me about 17 years ago, when I was single, living in Los Angeles, and not yet a mother. She had come to visit, and as she bent over her suitcase to unpack, she exclaimed, "I brought you the most hysterical thing." I was a little frightened. Past experience taught me that the object would not, in fact, be hysterical. Then I watched as she took a small, navy blue pillow out of her suitcase. She was already laughing. The pillow had a phrase embroidered on top. "If it's not one thing, it's your mother." I immediately hated the pillow for two reasons. One was that it was a play on an old catchphrase, "If it's not one thing, it's another." Gilda Radner's character on Saturday Night Live, Roseanne Rosanna Dana, used to say that phrase after she said, "It's always something." The association with Saturday Night Live was slightly irritating because I just left that very show, and although my departure was on friendly terms, I was feeling slightly wounded. However, many people, I think perhaps my mother is included in this group, assume that as a former cast member, I must love anything even slightly associated with SNL, and I feared that this was part of her assumption when buying that pillow. The second thing I hated was the rhyming pun. As a rule, I do not like those, in which the key word was mother, meaning that it was, of course, all about my mother. I thought the pillow may as well have been embroidered with, "My mother is a first-class narcissist, and all I got out of it was this stupid pillow." Come to think of it, there was a third reason I hated the pillow, the true objection at the root of it all. It was that the pillow indicated to whoever gazed upon it that my mother and I conversed in a casual yet intimate repartee of mutual ribbing, a jovial, "You drive me crazy, but I still love you" kind of thing. I felt that my mother and I did not have that kind of relationship. My mother held the pillow out toward me and I smiled, forcefully. "Isn't it hysterical?" she asked. "Yes," I said flatly. "Hysterical." As soon as my mother left town, I put the pillow in a closet. It only emerged when she came for a visit. I'd prop it up on the guest room bed ahead of her arrival.
We've just heard "If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother" by Julia Sweeney. Anne Lamott, daughter of writer Kenneth Lamott, grew up in California's Marin County. She attended Goucher College, wrote for the school newspaper, but dropped out after 2 years and returned to San Francisco. After briefly writing for Women's Sports Magazine, she began writing short pieces. The diagnosis of her father's brain cancer prompted her to write her first novel, Hard Laughter, published in 1980. Since then, she's written novels and works of nonfiction. Anne shares, quote, "I try to write the books I would love to come upon that are honest, concerned with real lives, human hearts, spiritual transformation, family secrets, wonder, craziness, and the ones that can make me laugh." Her book, Operating Instructions, is a raw and honest account of becoming a single mother and chronicles her son's first year of life. And now, in some assembly required, Anne revisits child rearing, only this time from a grandmother's point of view. In this memoir, Lamott takes her readers through the birth and first year of the life of her grandson, Jax, the son of her then 19-year-old son, Sam. Welcome, Anne. Thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Thanks, Elaine.
What made you decide to write Some Assembly Required?
Well, actually, my editor decided for me to write it. He and Sam, my child, my editor called and said, would you consider a follow-up book to Operating Instructions, and which had been a book somewhat about being a mother, about being just being alive in the world and just being here for a year. And I said, oh, I think it would be exploiting Sam and Amy, who's the mother of my grandson. And my editor said, well, not if you didn't exploit anybody, which actually hadn't even occurred to me. And so then I asked Sam, and if you read the preface of Some Assembly, you'll hear him talk about how much Operating Instructions meant to him and how he wanted to give Jax a book of his own.
Well, what was it like for you having your son contribute to the book?
Well, it's kind of dicey. He was 19. He was a full-time student, and he had a full-time infant. And so I had to rely on the exact same skills that I used during high school to get help him get his homework done, which were bribes and threats and bullying, withholding. And but whenever he would get the material into me, whether it was a set piece or a long email, it would be so touching and so funny that I would forgive him. I would like him all over again. And so we did it. I did the bulk of the writing. It's probably 80-85% me. And the rest is him. So, you know, it was just like writing everything. Some days went better than others.
Did you get any pushback from Amy, Sam's partner? Did she read a first draft, for example, and want changes?
Oh, I wouldn't have started it without her being glad to for me and Sam to be writing it. So I showed it to her every step of the way.
All right. Well, Sam became a dad when he was 19, which is quite a journey for someone his age. As a single mom yourself, how did you first take the news?
Well, of course, I was just shocked, and I had 20 people coming for Thanksgiving the next day, and he called and said, I'm going to be a father, and then he hadn't met his own father till he was 7, and so it was very, very important for him to stick around. And I was really shocked. I have learned to bide my tongue, and I did not say as much as I felt like saying. I just said, oh, Sam, and I actually got very happy about it pretty early on.
Well, from what I read in the book, you're an amazing grandmother. How has this experience impacted your life?
Well, in every possible way. Jax is 3.5 now, and so it's, grandparents, if they get to see their grandchildren, are just unbelievably happy and kind of annoying, I would say, including myself. But it just is unbelievable that you fall in love all over again, like you fell in love with your children, having thought that that was a once-in-a-lifetime deal. And you find out that you're just, a lot of the time, just as scared as you were with your kids. I mean, the nature of being a parent, it's not a Hallmark card. It's sometimes very scary, and children get very hurt and bullied, and it's a dangerous world. We're a vulnerable species, and you have to learn to live life on life's terms and release your child while doing everything you can to keep them safe and to help them grow into good people. So it's a lot the same with a grandchild, only it's not your kid, as your child and as both parents keep reminding you. They get to make their own mistakes. They are not interested in how you raised your child because it doesn't have anything to do with their child. And so You know, some days your feelings get hurt, and other days you're just so happy to get to play with a baby or a toddler or a little boy again.
Well, after reading the book, and I think you must hear this from all your readers, I feel concerned about Amy, Sam, and Jackson. As a young couple, they had some rough spots, of course. So is it a spoiler to ask how they're doing now?
Oh, no. The book goes until Jackson's first year birthday, and about a year later, Sam and Amy split up. That had always been probably in the cards. They're a very young couple, and they're both with new partners and have been for a while, and they live in the same county, and they live within about 40 minutes of each other, and they're raising their child together but from individually. So, again, it's life on life's terms. It's like maybe it's ideal for parents to stick together, but not in my experience. Certainly not my own house. It didn't work for my parents to stick together. And so you don't know what is best. You know, I think a lot of the book is about me thinking my ideas are good ideas and my help is helpful, and that if only everybody would do what I think is the best way to proceed, then people would be happy and blah, blah, blah. But it turns out not to be true. You know, a lot of the book is about trying to let go of control, letting go of control, taking it back, you know, breathing through the pain, breathing through the fear, because, you know, it's scary to be a parent. It's sometimes scary to be a grandparent.
Yeah. Well, how have, you know, all of your fans from Operating Instructions, how have they reacted to this book?
Oh, I think they just love it. It's on the New York Times bestseller list as of yesterday on the paperback, and it was for the hardback. So I think probably the people that liked Operating Instructions realized that they might like this also. So, and, you know, I'm on book tour, and everybody, the people that already like me, come to hear me read. So I believe everyone loves it, but that's not necessarily true. I like to think it anyway.
Yeah. Well, in your book, you also write about some of your travels. I've been to India twice, and I loved, for example, your description of the Ganges. Have you ever considered writing just a travel book?
No, I don't think so. I love the section on India, too. Thank you for saying that. But I love... I think it's a very unusual travelogue. I think Jax is about 6 months old when I went to India, and but I felt it was so important because, as you know, it just kind of blows apart your sense of the world to be with 1 billion other people, none of whom seem interested in your good ideas either. And it's so mystical, so earthy, so trippy, so different that it can't help but change you. And the same was towards later in the book when I went to Eastern Europe, and I got to go to the Solidarity Monument. I got to go to, I went to a concentration camp. I saw children's shoes flung over a sign. I got to realize what this species is capable. I got to realize how big our lives, our history, our everything is. I got to feel the extreme blessing and preciousness of having a child who's so safe, so loved, so chosen. So everything in the book, there's even a little book tour. There's Chicago, oh my God. So it takes place kind of in the bigger world too. It takes place in my mind a lot because most of my problems are mental. It takes place in sitting with Sam and Amy on the couch. It takes place in dreams. So it's probably like a lot of my books, a little hodgepodgey.
Well, on a separate note, I'm a huge fan of Stephen Colbert. How was it to be on the show?
Well, it was very scary, to be honest. It was one of the most frightened I've ever felt before I went on. But I had a lot of spiritual counseling, which is funny because he's very devout also, like I am, and he's a Sunday school teacher too. But he goes from being this brilliant, very sweet, decent guy to being in character. And I just had realized I didn't want to be like a backboard for him to hit tennis balls against, that I didn't want to try. Obviously, I don't think I could ever in a million years keep up with him. He's going to be the funniest one. And I actually talked to a minister, a Christian Science minister, before a healer, before I went on, and she said, "You are a little city on a hill, and you don't have to do anything but just sit there and shine." And so that really helped. I kept saying it to myself, I'm a little city on a hill, because it's very, very intimidating to be on his show.
I have to say that I really enjoyed operating instructions. You know, I'm not a grandma, I am a mom, and there was so much to connect to. I want to thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. I love talking to you. Thank you.
All righty. Bye.
Bye.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of Some Assembly Required, performed by the authors.
Jack, Sam, and Amy, who sometimes bicker and who are vaporous and otherworldly with fatigue, Trudy on a mattress in the kitchen nook, and the two big dogs and the cat, who is bitter. Jack mostly sleeps, nurses, poops, blinks at you with black goggle eyes, pees on you while you are changing him, passes out. Amy's mom is social and talkative, which is hard for me because I am usually just with myself all day. Trudy and Amy don't always get along. It is a pretty typical mother-daughter situation. Amy and Sam have huge needs for food, laundry, sometimes companionship, often isolation, but don't always know which, so it is exhausting to tiptoe around if they are not getting along, or to get dismissed, even when I am in my loveliest, least intrusive, most saintly mode. It is crowded and fraught here sometimes, as if everyone has PMS all at once, including Jack's, as she is frequently topless in their room because Jack's nurses so much and her bra hurts her. And under stress, I become National Geographic averse. I don't even especially like Sam going around without a shirt on. I want to shout, "Everybody must have clothes on when he or she is in my hut, and please use the forks, which you'll find in the basket in the center of the table." Other times, it's easy village living. Trudy and I happily doing housework together a lot, Amy nursing the baby every 2 hours. It would be as if a newborn kitten had a whole haggis. Yesterday, I was walking around the house with Jax, who was sleeping in my arms, and we really were the ultimate portrait of what heaven will be like. But when we came into Amy and Sam's bedroom, they were fighting about whether to separate or not. Just then I wish I had a gun so Jax and I could shoot our way out of this messy situation. And then I remembered, oh wait, they're the parents. Rats. So I transformed myself into Red Cross Field Station management nurse and mobilized Amy, Trudy, and Jax for his first stroller walk to the Redwood Park. That was lovely and great for Sam to have a little space, but I felt the burden of the fight and of our exhaustion. The small children on the structures at the park looked like linebackers and slavs compared with Jack's. I sneaked out that night to be alone in the car with the radio off and a bag of medicinal chocolate, although I had already gained 4 pounds in the hospital cafeteria during our stay and felt like a fat old granny. When I got back home, Sam was mean to me because I had forgotten to buy cereal, and Amy was mad at Trudy for talking too much, so Trudy and I sat on the couch together with blankies and my leftover chocolates and binged on legal shows. Through it all, though, the ups and downs, Jack shines like a pearl. Looking at Sam's and Amy's faces when they hold him, so madly in love, and watching Sam changing poopy diapers all the time nearly brings me to tears. My wild son, who, like most boys, smashed and bashed his way through childhood with branches and bats and wooden swords, who shut down and pulled so far away as a teenager that sometimes I could not find him, now taking tender care of his own newborn, a miniature who is both unique and reflective. Sam is still every age he ever was, from the fetus to the infant to the adolescent to the father. And Einstein would probably say that Jax is already every age he ever will be, but in such super slow motion relative to our limited perspective that we can't see the full spiral of him yet, only this tan bundle of perfect infanthood with a blue butt. One night I ran away from home and told everyone I was going to Bible study at St. Andrew, but instead I went to Macy's. I tried to shell out money on something really meaningless and bourgeois, like blusher or overpriced Peds, but I was too screwed up mentally, or too well, I'm not sure.
That was Some Assembly Required by Anne and Sam Lamont. Readers, mothers are central characters in all of our stories. If you're lucky enough to celebrate Mother's Day with your mom this weekend, perhaps include a book as one of her gifts. Check my website, bookreportradio.com, for a world of ideas. Thanks so much for joining us today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.